Work, wealth, wisdom. This is DC Entrepreneur. We're sharing stories, ideas, and lessons from startups and businesses in the pursuit of innovation. And we're helping build a community of problem solvers and thought leaders in the Washington area. Now, here's your host, George Mocharko.
This is George Mocharko, host of DC Entrepreneur, here on WERA FM 96.7. I'm here today with Alex Pasala. He is principal of Middle Lane Capital. Welcome today.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for having me.
So, Alex, I met you at a Brunchwork event a couple weeks ago, and you talked about your role as a VC in the DC entrepreneurship community and scene here. Can you talk to me about what the tech landscape looks like in Washington, DC right now?
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to do it. You know, I think for so long, when you thought of the DC area as it related to technology, it goes back a couple of decades around the time where, you know, the internet was just getting started. And then, of course, AOL was a company here that was just an absolute juggernaut that you know, really, really just was absolute the forefront of the internet, all things. And AOL became this humongous, humongous company. And then, you know, AOL had their merger with Time Warner. And then there was kind of this Web 2.0. And since then, I don't think there's been as much of an identity here in D.C. But I think in the last 3 to 4 years since the, you know, the economic recession, there's been a really good jumpstart re-jumpstart here in D.C. And what we're seeing is a really interesting landscape that's developing around a few different pockets. So some of that is what's going on with cybersecurity here in D.C. Some of that's what's going on in enterprise software, because, of course, the U.S. government is the largest buyer of enterprise software in the world. And then, of course, even outside of those areas, there's just a nice pocket of more traditional venture capital backed companies and technology companies that are developing here in the Beltway.
So I understand from your portfolio that you have a specific kind of interest in agricultural tech. Can you explain to our listeners what ag tech is and, you know, what kind of companies you're investing in?
Sure, absolutely. You know, for us, we like to think of very big themes and then distill that down to how to make an investment. And one of the biggest, you know, things that everyone's out there talking about and worrying about is that in 2050, there will be somewhere between 9 and 10 billion people in the world, which is just staggering if you think about the population growth. And now, in order to feed that many people, you're not able to just plant crops in more places, because we're dealing with a relatively finite resource, which is arable land. So if we're going to feed all these people and they're going to get, you know, some real quality nourishment, we're going to have to get better yields of agriculture. So that's kind of the theme that we're thinking about. How do we invest in technologies and innovations that are going to help the yield of agriculture and figure that out? And we have a very long time horizon on this, right? 2050 is a long time away from now. And so our belief, and this is a generalization, but by and large, I think it's accurate that the innovation and the technology for agriculture will largely come from the developed markets, where we have a lot more technology and folks working on things like that. But overwhelmingly, the applications for those technologies and the needs for those technologies are in the emerging markets. So if we look at how we hope this will play out, we're investing in companies in the U.S., Canada, Western Europe, a couple in Israel, one in, you know, Spain. These are not in the places where the population is going to grow as much. But over time, maybe a decade plus from now, we're going to have to start taking these technologies and applying them internationally so that we can, you know, grow enough food to feed all these people.
Yeah, it sounds like a great, noble idea. Do you think it'll work in practice?
Sure. I mean, look, at the end of the day, if you look at like agriculture just for centuries, right, there's been best practices that are then applied and brought to different areas. And we think that's going to continue to happen. It's not like it's something that we hope will happen. It's already happening. It's happened before, but from an investment standpoint, there's not many people that are looking at that. If you look at what most people think of when they think of venture capital, they think about these guys in Silicon Valley who are investing into the next Facebook or Snapchat or Instagram or whatever it is. agricultural technology is not really a big focus for a lot of Silicon Valley venture capitalists or venture capitalists at all. And there's a couple of reasons for that. The first is, you know, for lack of a better term, it's unsexy, right? These are not these high flying consumer focused applications that, you know, everyone has on their phone. Secondly, these companies are spread out, right? Most of our companies in agricultural technology companies in the U.S. are located, you know, where the row crops are. So that means we're getting on the plane a lot and going to the Midwest and, you know, going, stepping on farms and talking to farmers. That's very different than a traditional venture capitalist who can sit in Silicon Valley and have, you know, computer science grads from Stanford just come to their offices one after another and have an investment portfolio comprised of those brilliant people. And they are brilliant, but, you know, it's a little harder to find these agriculture companies. And then the third challenge why other people don't go after it, what I touched on before, is how long it takes. If you think about it, if you have a really good software product, you can bring it to me and I can say, no, it's no good. You have to change it. And you can go do that the next day. With agriculture, in order to test these technologies, you're dealing with crop cycles. So if I have something that I go to a potato farmer, I say, hey, this is going to double your yield for potatoes, and I give it to you to try, well, you try it, and maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. But then I can't really bring that back to you to try again until the next crop cycle and probably even maybe the next year, right? Unless I want to go down to the southern hemisphere and test it when, you know, the seasons are inverted. So the time it takes to really iterate and perfect a technology that's going to work for agriculture takes a long time. And venture capitalists don't like waiting that long because they want to make money and return it back to their investors. You know, we're blessed that all the money from Midland Capital comes from one investor who has a much longer term time horizon. So we're able to play that long game a little bit differently. So that's why a lot of people don't go after agriculture technology. And for that reason, we love it. You know, when everyone else is zigging, we like to zag, so to speak. So agriculture will always be something that we're really passionate about. And to your point earlier, it's a very good theme to be investing into, right? We're helping people in a way, and there's really some great global effects here from our portfolio, hopefully in the future.
So what does the future look like? Is it a product like Soylent? Is it something that's going to be, you know, nutritional supplements for people in developing countries? What is it going to be? Is it going to be a combination or synthesis of existing crops, or is it going to be something synthetic?
Sure. So, I mean, I think if you look at what's happened in the nearer term history, you're seeing that parts of the population are now getting access to higher nutrient foods, right? So they're able to start eating proteins more. They're starting able eating enriched foods a little bit more that are grown in the ground. And so really it's about access to the foods that are already out there. You know, it's not like we have to come up with some Frankenstein crop that's going to be something that we've never seen before. Really, it's just about the ability to affordably and reliably grow, you know, the higher nutrient foods in more places around the world. So how do we do that? We have a few different buckets that we think of. We have on the biotech side, there are things that you can do around, you know, coatings that go on seeds and the genetic side of agriculture. That's definitely one part. But, you know, where we end up spending most of our time is around an area we call precision agriculture, which is, you know, just using data on the farm. It might sound so intuitive and so obvious, but even some of the more developed countries like the U.S., it's staggering to us how little data analysis is being put onto the farm. So if I'm a farmer that has to have all these inputs, which is water and nutrients and fertilizers and all these things, and then I have my output, which is yield and waste, you know, how are we tracking this using data to be much more precise, right? Precision agriculture. Those types of things can be applied much more broadly. So if all of a sudden we have these best practices for, hey, in this, you know, crop condition, this weather condition, this is how you grow this crop, well, can we apply that to people who are maybe growing that crop for the first time so they don't have to deal with the same trial and error that someone who's already done it has? And then on the third bucket, I'd say, is kind of what we're seeing a lot of recently is more on the hardware side. So, you know, the Internet of Things is a big theme people talk about. So we have a company that puts moisture monitors in the soil. So in real time, you can see, well, I need to, you know, irrigate over here, or I've irrigated too much over there. Again, just to be more precise with your resources. We've seen a lot of companies lately with drones, right? Everyone's talking about drones, but very few of these drone companies actually have commercial applications that are really well-defined. Well, within agriculture, there's a whole host of things you can do. So we've seen companies that are taking, you know, this very specialized types of photography so that you can see the moisture level underneath the soil from an aerial view, which is just remarkable, or the ability to use robotics. Maybe it's not so much a drone, but just a robotics company that's allowing someone to be able to literally take a robot to go up and down the rows and cut crops or identify sick crops using a camera. It's just a staggering what the applications are. So that's kind of the way we think about ag tech, and we're trying to attack all of these at once.
So what you've described to me, it sounds like there's a knowledge transfer component there, as well as a concept that really goes even further, which is automating a lot of the process. Yeah, yeah. So does the future look automated? Is it going to be, or is it going to be a replication of what we have right now, which is the industrial food system, which, you know, some claim creates economies of scale, but at the other end, it also is destructive to livestock and the environment?
Yeah, automation is definitely happening. It's going to happen. It's happening right now. I think there's a number of reasons why people aren't always as enthusiastic about automation, because it replaces human labor, right? Which is doesn't always have all beneficial outcomes, right? Because those are jobs that are being replaced by folks that don't they're being replaced, and so those people then need to find different ways to make money inevitably. But yeah, automation is definitely happening on the farm. It's just such an efficiency driver. So I think the future will allow for a much more automation on the farm, and it will also allow places where there might be a labor shortage, or there might be a certain part of the cycle within growing foods or processing foods, especially, that automation can be quite beneficial.
And does it also look good for the producers, specifically producers in the U.S. Agricultural market? Is the new diet going to consist of existing crops, or is it going to be some kind of blend of new creations, new flavors?
Yeah, again, I don't know that we know the answer to that for sure, but I think what we're looking at and the types of companies we're talking about are existing crops that they just want to make more efficient, right? Yeah. There's always the people out there on the cutting edge. You know, you mentioned Soylent before, and is that going to replace food as we know it? And all, I don't know. Quite frankly, I like eating food that's a little bit varied. I don't know if I'd like drinking the same kind of food replacement shake, you know, every single day.
You haven't tried a juice diet then.
That's right. No, I probably should these days. But no, you know, I think really what we're looking at is just taking something that's out there already and how do we improve the process? And that's like most venture capitalists. You know, it's like my biggest pain in my rear is always seeing something that's inefficient. So how can we make this more efficient? Can we do it from a software approach? Can we do it from hardware approach? Can we do it from some other way operationally? That's kind of what we think about all day. And there's always going to be room for it. And the farmers are always going to love that because that ultimately increases, you know, their margin, right?
Yeah. And that's interesting because you mentioned the business requirements are completely different for agriculture because your inputs are varied and the cycle is so much longer.
Yeah.
So I think you really touched upon some very interesting things in there. So let's go to power supply.
Sure.
Talk to me about power supply. What exactly is your investment in power supply, and how is power supply benefiting the DC community, and are they expanding nationally?
Yeah, and to be clear, I mean, agriculture is a huge theme for us. It's something that we've been very active with for a while, but it's not our sole focus. So we actually do also have, you know, some investments that we work in that are outside of this agriculture component, and power supply is one of them. I mean, it kind of touches it because it has to deal with food, but again, power supply is a Virginia-based company that is really making the process of eating a lot easier, right? I think all of us have had that issue where lunchtime rolls around and you have so many different options, and it's just it burns your mental capacity to even think about what am I going to eat today, or you get home from work at the end of the day and then you have to cook and do all these things, and it's just a nightmare, especially when you have a family. So what Power Supply is, for those that don't know, is a company that finds the top chefs in an area and top, professional kitchens out there, and has them prepare meals that are kind of for a certain type of diet. So it could be vegetarian, it could be paleo, which is incredibly common within the fitness and CrossFit community. It could be a little mix of both. And what they do is they take these high quality meals prepared fresh and then delivered to you in a much easier way. And by that I mean, you know, not delivering to your house and then it's sitting on your front step and you know, someone takes it or it's exposed to the elements and they have to worry about it every day. It's more that if you go to a gym or at your office or at your doctor's office in the future, you know, there's a refrigerator there where, you know, they're dropping off these meals. And so while you're going about the things that you're already doing, like going to the gym, going to the office, you're able to pick up these meals. And behind the scenes, Power Supply is, you know, delivering from the kitchens to these endpoints for you and figuring out what are the best types of meals and really optimizing for just an amazing, amazing selection of meals. So to answer your question, it's a fantastic concept. It's one that, you know, we personally had, you know, felt the pain of having to sit there every day and what am I going to have for lunch? And I'd love to eat healthy, but that requires, you know, going a little further away. And so these are very, very healthy meals. They're delicious. And, you know, I'm a big guy. They fill me up really well too. So it's not like you're eating a few leaves or something. It's really high quality food and it's delivered right through my gym, which is amazing. They are, you know, a local company, but they have aspirations outside of the market. So they've already expanded out to the West Coast in LA and San Francisco. And in the coming months and years, they're going to be expanding to several more areas because the demand is just, you know, is just stammering. How many people really love this? You know, it's fresh. It's healthy, it's convenient, and it's affordable, right? It's not like you're spending $20-something a meal, which most people would never be able to do. But there's been a lot of different people going about this issue. This, you know, there's the folks that are sending, you know, kind of ingredients in the mail so you can make the meals at home, like Blue Apron and those kind of companies. There's other folks that are trying to do on-demand delivery, which like Uber for food delivery kind of analogy, which is also interesting. But, you know, we think this model works for everyone.
So where is most of the competition coming from? Is it from like your Relays, your kind of grocery delivery services like Peapod? Or is it like the Blue Aprons that have like meals in a kit that you assemble at home? Sure. Or is it going to be, you know, ultimately prepared meals that you get?
Yeah, it's coming. There's not one in particular that is really jumped out as the competitor, right? Which is actually, I like that because I think what we're doing is pulling in people from several different, you know, status quos, which all are not optimal, right? Again, I think making meals yourself is great. And I think it's also educational, right? So I think that's why Blue Apron and Plated have been really cool because people learn how to make food. But the reality is that, you know, do you want to have to make your own meal every single night for your family and with all these instructions and ingredients and all that type of stuff? I think most people say no, you know, they do occasionally. So this is not as much an everyday thing. I think of Power Supplies, it could literally be the only place you get food, breakfast, lunch, dinner, and it would be perfect. It would be, there'd be variety, there'd be high quality all the time, and it would be affordable. So, you know, there's really no other source out there that kind of checks all those boxes. And I think in a time where people are thinking a lot more about what they're putting in their body, and rightfully so, they're looking for high quality ingredients, things that are possibly organic, things that are local, things that have been vetted, right? Not something that, you know, who knows where it came from or how long it's been sitting on the shelf, right? These are top tier chefs, top tier kitchens, professional through and through. And so you basically get like a high end restaurant type meal delivered to you very conveniently and at a fraction of the price.
So let's talk about some of the other companies that are in your portfolio here. Just to name a few, Contactually, Urban Stems, you've got a number of different others. Nice Socks is one in particular that I'm a great fan of them.
Nice Laundry. They're another one of our nice companies that started in DC. No problem. They were a DC company. They moved to New York, which is fine because it's still close enough. But yeah, we've got a pretty diverse portfolio of companies here in DC. And again, this is outside of that agricultural thing I'm talking about. These are just DC technology companies. They could be software companies. They could be consumer apps. They could be really anything. And the reason why we've done that as well, again, taking from a big theme down to how do we make an investment, DC is amongst the most affluent and intelligent areas in all of the United States, right? And generally, when you put that many intelligent people in one area, you're going to get a lot of really high caliber entrepreneurs and really great technologists. Now, when that happens, usually there should be a corresponding amount of capital out there from venture capitalists who give these smart people, you know, some money to go build these really interesting things. For whatever reason, in DC, in the last 5-10 years, there's been a huge imbalance there. So we think there are far more interesting companies and entrepreneurs and technologists here than there are dollars going to their ventures. So what we decided to do was create a fund that was focused almost exclusively on helping companies headquartered here in DC, Maryland, Virginia, kind of in the Beltway, to scale in the early days. So we've assembled a portfolio about 12 to 15 companies already in the last 3-4 years. You mentioned a lot of them that are going after very different types of problems, but you know, we think DC has a lot of promise, and it, you know, it's not Silicon Valley and it's not like other areas, and we shouldn't try and replicate those areas. But I think DC is a tremendous advantage to starting and growing a business here, between the government and what it has, between how international and diverse this area is. I think there's tremendous reasons why starting a company here makes sense, and we want to be a part of a lot of those companies.
Is there an underlying theme that you've seen to a lot of the businesses that are in the DC tech landscape? Is there some kind of underlying similar type of approach or idea? I mean, what are you seeing the most of right now?
Sure. There definitely are some things that make more sense here in DC, and we're seeing a lot more of. The first, I'd say, is cybersecurity. I think cybersecurity is on everyone's mind, no matter where you are. But if you look at a lot of the really intelligent and gifted people from that community, they're all here in DC. And maybe they're not working for private companies, they're working in the public sector. But you know, when you want to start a private company and you want to pluck up the talent that's out there to create best-in-class cybersecurity solutions, you come to DC, right? So we see a lot of cybersecurity companies being started here in DC, and looking for funding and doing really interesting things. As I mentioned before, the U.S. government is a huge buyer of enterprise software. So more than anything, in DC, we're seeing a lot more enterprise or business-to-business solutions out there. We're not seeing as many consumer-focused things. You know, power supply is one, but just in general, we're not seeing as many consumer-focused companies as you'd see in a New York or an L.A. or a San Francisco, but that's okay. You know, again, I think there's always going to be you can start an amazing company anywhere. That's my thesis. It doesn't matter where you are. It might be a little easier or it might be a little more comfortable to start it somewhere, but you can start an amazing company anywhere, no matter what type of company it is. But of course, there will be company reasons and pockets of technology that will always be a focus here in DC.
So I think that's an interesting thing that you mentioned there, is that it's not just B2B or B2C, it's B2G.
Right. Right.
I know Fiscal Note is actually one of the companies that you invest in, sure, which is government relations
software.
Yeah,
I mean, Fiscal Note is basically what we like to think of like a lobbyist's best friend, right? And so if you're a large company, say the Coca-Cola's of the world, you know, at any given time, you're looking at probably hundreds of types of regulation that impact your business, right? There's what's going on with the, you know, regulation around minimum wage, and what's going on with regulation around, you know, diets and stuff that can be served in schools, and what's going on with regulation around international trade. Like, if you're, you know, working at a multinational company, you're looking at so many types of regulation. And how do you monitor that, right? Traditionally, people have employed people to have a pulse on what's going on the Hill. And you pay these people a lot of money, these lobbyists, and they run around and they talk to the people they talk to. And you get a decent idea of what's going on, hopefully in somewhat real time. Well, Fiscal Note said, look, there should be a data-driven approach to this. And so if we can have a pulse on what's going on with the government, but we can also use machine learning and natural language processing and all these really cool technologies to figure out if regulation will even hit the floor, and if it hits the floor, if it's going to pass or not. It's amazing, their accuracy rate. It's over 95%, I think, for some areas in predicting whether legislation and the regulations will come through, which is just amazing if you're a company to be able to pay for a software product that will tell you that. I don't think it replaces completely the lobbyists out there. Of course, I don't think anyone's purported to say that will be the case, but it's more just a tool to be able to to see things, even at the state level, internationally. I mean, there's just so many use cases for it. So yeah, that's a company that does make sense to be in DC, right? You wouldn't want to start that company in Silicon Valley because, you know, ultimately all big companies have their government affairs and people here in DC, right? That this is where the action is happening. So that's an amazing company that is definitely selling to enterprises. They're not selling to the government, but all the data and all the content that's flowing through their software product is all here in the Beltway. So it's a great DC company.
Do you define yourself as a venture capitalist, or Sure. Do you just call yourself an investor? What would VCs call themselves?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, I think a lot of these definitions are vague and they're changing more than anything, right? Like, what is a venture capitalist is changing quite a bit nowadays from what it was maybe in the 70s and 80s. But yeah, absolutely. We are venture capitalists. We're investing in early stage ventures where we like to see these companies grow and then obviously make a return on that investment at some point.
So the burning question, I think, from all the interviews that I've done prior to this episode, which have been with DC, mainly technology companies that Sure. are startups, is what is it like to be on the other side of the desk? When they're pitching you, what types of things do you hone in on? Like what basically in a pitch or a slide deck, what do you look for? Is it, Sure. is it the numbers? Is it the idea? Is it the ideas? Ability to be executed?
Sure.
Is it the person? Is it the team?
Yeah.
What is it?
It's all those things. but, you know, I think first I'd like to say that it's impossible to paint all venture capitalists as the same because everyone invests at different stages in a company. So there are some people who invest when there's not even a company. It's a couple of guys in a garage somewhere and they just have an idea. And then there's people that invest in companies that are, you know, 6 months away from an IPO on the stock market, and they're huge companies doing hundreds of millions in revenue. So they look for different things, obviously based on where the life cycle of the company is. But, you know, to answer your question a little more closely, at the end of the day, what we're looking for is, or what we're betting on is people. Right. And these people are creating technologies and they're doing all these things, you know, the financials and all these things you mentioned that might be in a pitch deck. And that's all important, surely. But we're betting on people. We are in the people business. We're betting on them. So what we're really looking for is top tier entrepreneurs. And what does that mean? Those are people that are very, you know, they're obviously intelligent and gifted and have probably backgrounds in the ecosystem that they're building a product for, but they have self-awareness. They are not overly cocky. They are able to, you know, attract people to work with them, right? They're the kind of people you'll want to work with because inevitably it's not just about one person or a few amount of people. If you're going to build a huge company, more than likely you're employing thousands and thousands of people, and that can't happen if you're not someone that people want to work with or you're not a good leader or a good manager, right? There's a lot of people out there that are very smart, very gifted, but they're not good at managing people. Well, how are you going to build a business that way? So I'd say overwhelmingly, we spend the most of our time thinking about and getting to know people. So we're spending time just getting to know them, seeing how they think, figuring out their viewpoints on various things. And then, of course, we want to know about the product and the market that they're going after and who the competitors are out there and the business model and all those types of things. And those are all important to show that you know what you're about to step into. But, you know, at the end of the day, we are investing into companies for what might be 7 to 15 years, right? It could take that long for a company to go from idea to being a billion-dollar plus outcome. So it's almost like a marriage in some ways. We're stepping into a very long-term engagement, and unlike marriage, you can't just get out of it so easily, right? It's not as easy as divorce, which seems to be happening so often these days with marriages. It's a very long-term commitment, and there's going to be a lot of ups and downs. So we just really want to find quality people. And then, of course, you know, everything else has to come with it. But more than anything, the advice to entrepreneurs and folks that come on your podcast or otherwise would be really don't get bogged down too much in the details. You'd be amazed. Every single one of our companies, if we look at where they are now to where they were when they pitched us, if we go back and look at their financial projections and we go back and look at their product timeline of when they're going to be able to build a product and we look at what they think their org chart will be 2-3 years out, every single one of them is wrong. And it's not because they're not intelligent. It's not because they're not some of them have built several companies successfully before this. It's just because you never know what's going to happen. Right. You know, I think, you know, it's like that Mike Tyson quote. Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. You know, it's there's going to be ups and downs. There's going to be macro things that you can't help. There's going to be people leaving and quitting and other big competitors. You know, there's so many variables that go into it. More than anything, we just want to find resilient people who can get through that.
So is there anything else you'd like to add about your work? I mean, how did you become an investor? Was there a career track progression that you kind of were on? I mean,
truthfully, coming out of college, I didn't. If you asked me what a venture capitalist does, I would have absolutely no idea. I went into financial services right out of college, like most of my classmates were. But at the time, it was a very different financial climate than it had been in recent years. And very quickly, I decided I can't do this. I can't work at a big financial institution. It's just there's so much bureaucracy. It's not for me. I want to go work at a small company. I want to see what that's like. So I went. I didn't start my own company, but I joined a very early stage company that was headquartered here in D.C. There was a classmate of mine from school that was working there. And said, "Hey, why don't you come do this?" And we did it. I joined. And then 3-4 months after I joined, we raised venture capital money from a firm up in Boston, a really great one. And they gave us a whole lot of money, something like $12 to $13 million. And all of a sudden, we could just start growing much quicker than we were. So we decided, hey, well, we're going to open an Asia office, right? We need to get this product on the ground in Asia and start selling out there. So I went out there. I moved out to Singapore. You know, I was in my young 20s, had no idea what that was going to be like. But I thought, you know, why not? And for the better part of 2 years was spending time really building out the Asian operations for this company, which was amazing. And because at any given time, I was doing anything from marketing to business development to sales to hiring people, you know, literally everything in a business other than actually building the product, because my technical skills are not something that you would want to pay me to do. I'll put it that way. And I got infected. It was so amazing to be around a high growth atmosphere with people working on things. And I said, this is amazing. I want to do this for myself or be surrounded by it as much as I can. But one of the most dangerous attitudes out there is to want to start a company just for the sake of starting a company. Again, you know, you have to be ready for it, but you also have to have a very good idea. And you have to really have that be something that for 7+ years is going to be driving you to not give up and to keep going with it. And I didn't have anything like that. There was no, this is this problem I've always wanted to solve in my life. So I decided to become a venture capitalist because it would allow me to be surrounded by, so many other entrepreneurs who are working on things like that, where maybe I could help them as an investor as opposed to an employee. And I thought in the back of my mind, you know, once I kind of find that idea, then I will go start it. I'll stop being a VC and I'll go start my own company. And, you know, now almost 4 years later, you know, I haven't yet found that thing that has compelled me to go to the other side of the table, but, you know, I'm never taking that out of the options.
Exit strategies. Yeah. I know some people love them, some people hate them. What's your attitude towards an exit strategy? Is that just someone that's...
You know, look, exits, what that means for us is eventually, you know, we invest in a company, eventually we have to have a return on that investment, and that's called an exit. Now, that could be an acquisition, that could be an IPO on the stock market, or that could be something unique like a dividend, perhaps, or something like that, although that's not too common. You know, we think about that a lot. It's as part of our investment process is modeling out what we think will happen to this company. And we have some companies that we know can be acquired very easily, whether they're small, medium, or very large. And then we have other companies that maybe because of the industry they're in or the type of business model they have, it's a little more of a binary outcome. They have to be quite large in terms of users or customers or whatever it might be for it to be acquired. It probably can't get acquired in the short term. And that's okay as long as you go into it knowing that. So we absolutely think about exits. We absolutely think about how do we underwrite every single investment internally so that we can, you know, think of our portfolio strategy pretty in a sophisticated way. But it's also a little bit dangerous when you're an entrepreneur and you're just getting to know someone about getting into your company and you're already talking about how you're going to get out of it. I think at the end of the day, the top 1%, you know, that top tier entrepreneurs, they view it more as, look, there's a fundamental problem out there that I'm trying to solve. And we're going to build a huge business out of that. And now there will always be ways to make money when we build a huge business. But, you know, there's a great saying I always think about is that great companies are bought, not sold. And what that means is If you're the kind of entrepreneur or CEO out there who's constantly talking to big companies and investment banks and, you know, trying to sell your company subtly or not so subtly, that's never going to be as successful an outcome as if you're heads down, building great product, attracting top talent, and really solving that fundamental problem. Someone out there will try and buy you no matter what.
That's fascinating because I think most, if not all, of the entrepreneurs seem to think the focus of what they do is sales.
Right.
I mean, we're all doing sales, sure. Right?
Everyone's selling something, right?
So I get that. But the thing is sales that necessary? I mean, when you come in to a company and you decide to take an investment with them, mm-hmm. are you familiar with the show of Silicon Valley?
Oh, yeah.
So there's this perception that VCs come in and they basically are plundering, I guess, in
sure,
a sense.
Yeah.
But I mean, in a sense, they're helping foster a stage of growth.
Right.
So really, like, what is the process that you go through when you're working with entrepreneurs? Are you grooming them?
It's a great question because I think far too much of the attention in this industry is on making the investment or selling the beginning or the end of the investment. And overwhelmingly, our time is spent in the middle, right? When we're stepping into an investment, we're making that relationship. Then the hard work starts. You know, that wasn't the hard part. That was the easy part, saying, yeah, I like you, you like me, let's make a deal. That takes, you know, a very short amount of time and is pretty standard. The hard part and what separates the good VCs from the bad VCs in terms of performance and everything else is how they work with the companies. And this is where I think VCs are, there's the most variety out there, and it's hard to paint a picture. The way we think about it is because we're investing in such a diverse number of diverse types of companies, it would be impossible to go to an entrepreneur and say, hey, I have deep domain expertise in your industry. I know it inside and out, and do that for all these different areas, right? It would be really difficult to say that because you can't be an expert on everything. Some people might think they are, but you can't be. So we think of it as, well, what are some things that are universal to all companies, regardless of the business model, regardless of the stage of the company, regardless of the industry? And that comes down to a few things. First of all, it's talent. If you ask any good CEO out there what their number one concern is, what's keeping them up at night, it's finding, attracting, and retaining top talent. A CEO's first job always has to be out there finding amazing people to come work for their organization, because you're going to be scaling, you're going to be growing. You have to be thinking about that constantly. So we can be helpful in that way because we have a network of folks, and we have, you know, just come across literally 5,000 entrepreneurs and operators over the last half decade. And these people are, you know, we're constantly saying, oh, you know, what about someone like from this background? What about something from that? So we can basically be the outsourced recruiter for these companies for some of their senior positions, which I love doing because you get to learn a lot about the company that way. A second thing that we work on with, you know, nearly any company is kind of their financial and capital strategy. Very few companies only raise venture capital money once. It's rare. And if they do, it's because they get acquired early. And that's, again, very rare that happens. Most companies that go on to be successful raise several rounds of funding. And so what we like to do is say, look, we're going to invest in your company and we're going to give you this money. And that will probably last you about a year and a half to 2 years based on your projections. And we think they're, you know, pretty sensible. But if you do everything you say you're going to do, you know, then there's going to be an opportunity to raise more money to accelerate this even further, because you will have brought a lot of risk off the table and proven a lot of things. And thus you can attract a whole new set of investors. So in many ways, the minute I invest in a company and start work with them, I'm already thinking, okay, how do we make sure that this is a company that can raise more funding, maybe from groups that aren't us, a bigger fish out there who can put a bigger check in and work with different, add value in a different way. We're helping them with that process. And it takes a while because you're out there, you know, talking, you know, the phrase, you have to kiss a lot of frogs before you find the prince. I mean, you're talking about dozens and dozens of conversations with different groups who all have different questions. And so the more I can take that work off the shoulders of a CEO, and the more they can just spend actually building their company, I'm happy to do that. We're happy to do that. And then I'd say the third way we work with companies is ultimately around more of their business challenges, tweaks in the business model, thinking through pivots and new lines of business. You know, at the end of the day, we see a lot of the same type of problems and issues coming up across several companies. So we can help spread those best practices and those learnings to an entrepreneur and be a good sounding board. More than anything, I think there's a great VC who once said, like, he just thinks of himself as, you know, like a psychologist, right? And I think empathy is a huge quality to have as a VC, because it's believe it or not, it can be very lonely to be an entrepreneur, right? You're building this big company and everyone's looking at you. You're the CEO, you're the founder, whatever it is. And if you don't have someone that you can talk to and kind of not vent, but, you know, just have as someone to talk to and work through some really critical issues, it gets lonely. So most of the conversations that we'll have with an entrepreneur a lot are, yeah, here's this business decision we have to make, but what are the effects of that? You know, what is this going to mean for your team and your culture and all the other things that really are going to be the meaningful determinants of your success? So that's kind of what we spend the most time thinking about and talking through.
Perfect. Now, let's just go back a little bit here.
Sure.
Risk.
Yeah. Risk.
So entrepreneurship is fraught with risk, right? I mean, it's just more so than probably other investments.
Right.
I mean, if you want secure investments, you can probably go to the New York Stock Exchange and find something a little less risky.
Somewhere.
Right.
Yeah.
But how do you hedge the risk? How do you manage those kind of things? I mean, what types of things do you look for in a company whenever you see that there's going to be some red flags and there might be some risks?
Yeah, look, every single investment has risks. Anyone who thinks they have a risk-free investment is fooling themselves. I think they're and by the way, most of the things that end up becoming the issues with a company are often very rarely understood at the time you make the investment, right? So even there's tons of risk you don't even know when you're looking at these companies. So anyone who thinks they have it all figured out, if you have that Matt crystal ball, come call me because I've never seen it. I when we think about risk, we think of the types of risk we're willing to take. Now, we're always going to be okay taking some risk on the technology side, that it'll be very hard to build a technology product or advanced software. That's something that, you know, we can somewhat vet because we've seen a lot of other companies building technology and we can try and assess that risk. We're also very comfortable taking the risk of, hey, there's big competitors out there who could see what I'm doing, realize that it's interesting, and then try and build it themselves and squeeze us out. We're always willing to take that risk. You know, the risks that we're not willing to take are red flags around, trust. You know, if we don't fundamentally believe that we can trust what an entrepreneur is telling us, or there's little red flags that pop up around, you know, just inconsistencies with things they've said and then other things that we're surfacing through doing references and that type of stuff, those things we walk away from. You know, we kind of have a no jerk rule internally. Like if someone just kind of seems like there's just for whatever reason, there's something about them that we just can't really put our finger on, then it's not worth doing. You know, there are thousands of companies that we see a year out there. There's no reason to do one just because, you know, you want to do a deal. In many ways, we are trying to always get better at making sure that we assess the risks that we can and figure out what we're comfortable with. And have it be upfront, and then everything else, if there's anything that pops up, then just be okay walking away from a deal, even in the 11th hour. And it's a hard discipline to develop because a lot of times you get emotionally interested in a deal or a technology and you're like, oh, this is, I want it so bad. And then that can sometimes take, you know, your focus away from things that don't really seem right, but you just want to get the deal done. So you don't really, don't really dig deeper. And then inevitably it comes back to bite you a little bit later. So the risk is always something that we're going to take. We're in the business of mitigating risk. Venture capital is amongst the risk, if not the riskiest investments you can make, but thus in an ideal world, you're also getting the highest reward, right? The risk reward always has to be on the same level. So we're taking a lot of risk, but we're hoping for a lot of reward on it.
Are we in a bubble now, or do you think that there's going to be continued investments in the tech landscape and in the small business landscape in DC nationally and in these ecosystems?
Yeah, I mean, by definition, I don't think if everyone knows you're in a bubble, it can't be a bubble, right? But I will say this. You know, there has been, because of low interest rates and a number of other things, there's been a huge influx in terms of the amount of dollars going into this asset class. And so when you have a lot of people that are all chasing after a relatively fixed amount of opportunities, it creates a scenario in which entrepreneurs are being given more and more money before they're ready for it. And it also, if access to capital is so high and it's so easy to raise money, it really doesn't require an entrepreneur to have the same discipline as where times are tough and capital's not so accessible. So what I think more than anything in the last 3 to 6 years, whatever it's been, 7, you've seen a lot of companies that haven't really figured out a business model, but haven't failed. And they haven't failed because they've been able to raise venture capital dollars to keep them alive. And so what we've seen, and a lot of these companies, especially in the West Coast where the capital is the most available, these companies are growing like crazy and all the top line metrics are fantastic. And you read all these amazing projections, but they're not profitable. They're not even close. They don't even have an idea of if they can be profitable, right? They have an idea of how they can try, but they don't know. They haven't done it yet. And so what that's created is all these huge, huge companies that require a whole lot of capital just to exist because they're losing so much money on their actual business. And they're only being supported by these venture capital dollars that are so ample. Well, all of a sudden, you know, there's a pullback in the public markets and that trickles down to the private markets. And those venture dollars are now not so accessible. And then these companies kind of freak out because now they cannot continue to just raise more money because it's being handed to them. All of a sudden, they have to go and raise money in a time where venture capitalists are a little more skeptical. And when venture capitalists are a little more skeptical, you know, they want to see more certainty around your business model and your profitability and your exit and how you're going to, you know, not be hemorrhaging so much capital at a given time. So some of these companies did that. They got profitable or they're heading towards it and they kind of got a little more sensible. Other companies couldn't do it. And they have failed and will continue to fail. So, you know, you heard a lot about this unicorn phenomenon where everyone wanted to be a unicorn company, and a unicorn meaning they were a company worth $1 billion or more on, you know, as of their last valuation. Well, I feel like that just created this horrible cycle where everyone just wanted to get to that valuation in any way possible, spending as much money as quickly as they could. And then all of a sudden these unicorns have to become real, right? And unicorns aren't real. So to continue the analogy, but in all seriousness, these companies, I'm not blaming the VCs. No one's solely to blame. It was a lot of what was going on. They were just being encouraged to grow these businesses in a way that wasn't fundamentally sound. And then some of those that would become public companies, there was a lot of backlash against that, right? Wall Street didn't like that a lot of these companies were losing money or had, you know, several years of losses ahead of them. So
IPO companies.
And there haven't even been that many IPOs. I think there was one in all of Q1 of this year for tech companies, one IPO, right? And even the ones that did get out ahead of that, like Twitter, like, you know, Etsy, they have not performed well. And you know, like, I don't know enough about those companies specifically to be able to classify them as part of this problem or other problems. But the point is, you know, when the exits don't even look that good, the IPO market doesn't look that hot, then VCs are sitting like, well, wait a minute, we have all these big companies that we thought we could IPO, but now we can't. What do we do with them? How are we going to, you know, what do you do? And so it all trickles down, right? I think in DC, to answer the second part of your question, we're not seeing as much of that. And the reason is because the pendulum did not swing so far the wrong way to begin with. So the correction, so to speak, was not so profound. You know, there weren't several hundred millions of dollars of venture capital pumping into these companies around here in DC, allowing them to be wildly unprofitable and just grow at all costs. I mean, that doesn't really exist around here. As I mentioned before, you know, there's not enough VCs around here at all, let alone too many VCs. So, you know, I don't really think there was too much of that unicorn frenzy going on around here. There's probably a little bit of it. But again, the correction was a lot easier for those companies. But it does affect us. Inevitably, anything that's going on in the venture capital macro environment is going to affect all VCs, no matter where you are. So I think it's required everyone to just be a little more careful with how they're trying to plot out the future and what those companies will require to grow, because the availability of capital is not something that you can always control.
Valuations. Sure. So where do valuations come from?
Yeah, a lot of people think they get pulled out of a magic hat.
Yeah, are they market-based?
So I think there's kind of two valuations at any given time, right? There's the absolute valuation, which is, you know, there's very simple ways to, you know, using discounted cash flows or financial modeling to figure out what the value of a company is based on future earnings and looking at cash flows and balance sheets and income statements and all that type of stuff. Those are pretty well established concepts that everyone's pretty familiar with. The problem, however, is that it's really hard to tell how a company is going to be generating, you know, their business 5 years out when they're doing something that's so disruptive or so new, or they might be able to add on different business lines. So the assumptions going into that process are very difficult. The second part of valuations, what I call relative valuations, which are not just about the company itself, but about what's going on with other companies in your space, other companies in the larger ecosystem, what's going on in the public markets. And so I think, and also, you know, the third part is, you know, how competitive of a deal it is to give you a valuation, right? If I'm the only person who wants to invest in your company, I have a lot of leverage in negotiating with you on what the valuation should be. But if there's 40 venture capital funds that want to give you money, you can run a little bit of a bidding process or an auction and have it maybe get up a little bit. Again, I would argue that that creates the problem I just described with all this money trying to chase too few opportunities. But, you know, inevitably a valuation should be ideally a combination of financial projections and you know, really, really strict financial guidelines, as well as the assumptions around what's going on with the rest of the industry and your market specifically and how your competitors, you know, are being traded publicly. How does that, you know, the multiples, how do they affect your company? You know, we try and be pretty strict on valuations because we see, again, we're very long-term focused. We know that some of this macro stuff will come and go and there will be the ups and the downs and the sideways and everything else. But, you know, we want to make sure that when we're investing in a company, we're investing at a good, at the right valuation, regardless of what, you know, might be happening 3 or 5 years out. But it's hard to do. You know, it's hard for entrepreneurs to understand sometimes because they're not doing this as much. They've only thought about the valuation of one company, which was theirs. You know, we're doing this kind of every day for several companies, but it's something that more than anything, I'll say, I'm very happy about this. It's just becoming more transparent. I think because of now data that's out there and the fact that entrepreneurs are able to interact with each other and see how other companies are raising and at what levels, it's becoming much more transparent and it's becoming easier to understand, which is great for entrepreneurs as opposed to what it might have been decades ago where it was a big black hole. So I think it's overwhelmingly getting better for in terms of transparency and that's always a good thing.
Well, Alex, this has been a fascinating discussion. Thanks so much for joining me here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been great.
For more information, you can go to middlelandcapital.com. Thanks for joining us. Tune in next week for another episode of DC Entrepreneur.
Subscribe to this podcast via iTunes and connect with us on our blog, dc-entrepreneur.com. If you have any tips or ideas for stories, please tweet at us or message us on Facebook. Please tune in to our next episode, and thanks for listening.